Hi, this is Anthony Pascal.
And this is Laurie Ulster.
And welcome to All Access Star Trek for our first podcast focused on Season 3 of Star Trek Discovery.
Woohoo! We're going to talk the season premiere, which is called That Hope Is You Part 1. But first, we're going to talk about some news because there was actually a lot of it in the last week or so. I think we should start with Lower Decks. What do you think?
Yep, probably the biggest news came from a bunch of post-finale interviews from Mike McMahon. One bit was he confirmed that Frakes is back, but Sirtis is not.
Which made me happy and then sad.
I mean, it sounds like, well, he's confirmed that we're going to see the Titan, but I don't think we're going to see it for long. Reading between the lines sounds like there's going to be a quick transition to somehow get Boimler back to the Cerritos, so we'll see a little bit of Frakes, and then we'll be leaving the Titan to return to everyone at home.
Right, which makes sense. They got to get him back. But he talked about some other stuff that I found very interesting, actually, which was about sexuality on Lower Decks.
You know, that came up as a surprise in an interview with Variety where Mike was just talking about the season in general, and he mentioned Mariner's ex-girlfriend, Captain Ramsey. And you know, the interviewer had to kind of confirm, you know, they were lovers. And he's like, well, yeah, but I guess we just didn't make a big deal out of it. But it's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, it's good that they don't. I've seen fans on Twitter talking about how they felt an absence of that on the show, that it felt like a very, very heterosexual show. I think up until Rutherford and Bellops, maybe. But but I think it's good that he is thinking that way, actually. I think it's important to include that stuff. And I like that he's not talking about addressing it in an issue way. He's just saying that he basically says everybody is kind of baseline bisexual on the show.
I mean, it was an interesting thing he said. I think what he's saying there is we haven't really said what everyone's sexuality is, and anyone could be anything, is I think what he's saying.
Yeah.
But we may in future seasons explore, you know, with this character being bi, this character being gay, this character being straight. I mean, Ransom seems pretty straight.
Yes.
But, you know, so I don't think he's saying everyone in Starfleet's bi. He's just saying, you know, they really didn't get into it. And so they weren't really making strict decisions in season one. But in a way, I almost feel like Mike doesn't feel super comfortable with this. He kind of admitted this isn't his wheelhouse in doing, you know, but he's definitely going to try more, and the writing team in season two.
Right. And that's why you have a nice, diverse writing team, so you can cover all these things. But I think it's great that they're thinking about it. And I'm sure it will give us more fun stories because it's just more options to have characters pair up for whatever reason.
Yeah.
I think I was just going to say, it's really about not having limits versus making a point, which I like.
Now, speaking of pairing up, he said we will be seeing pairs, not in a relationship type thing, but just episodes where you see Tendi and Mariner doing something together, because we saw a lot of Tendi and Rutherford and Mariner and Boimler's episodes. And I think season two, they want to mix that up and see other combinations.
Which is good. It's like a Star Trek tradition. All the shows, right, like to pair people up from time to time. And you have the ones you're used to, like Geordi and Data. And then every once in a while, they just put two people together that you're not used to, like Picard and Wesley Crusher.
He talked a little bit about uniforms and how there's multiple uniforms, but, you know, read it on the website. He basically said that they may play around with this idea that there's lots of uniforms in Starfleet.
Which there are.
Exactly. The biggest news of the week has probably come from the man in charge of all of Star Trek in TV, Alex Kurtzman, in a couple of different interviews.
Separately from everybody thinking that he's getting fired and the show is over, which is often a sentiment, instead he's making plans for many years into the future.
Indeed. He specifically said through 2027.
Right.
That doesn't mean all of these shows have been greenlit to 2027, but his company, Secret Hideout, and CBS are thinking about the long term of Star Trek and planning out where things are headed with the television franchise. And it's good that they are having these kind of long term points of view instead of being constantly reactionary, especially because some of these shows, all of them have a really long lead time, especially the animated shows.
Right. And the live action shows, because of COVID, things get delayed there too. So they definitely take longer to do, but I like that they're obviously planning a multiple future seasons of Discovery. Not that anything's been signed, sealed, and delivered, but they're clearly planning it and thinking that way.
Well, I mean, it's getting a little ridiculous at this point why CBS has not announced the fourth season of Discovery.
Yeah.
Because they're planning on going into production fairly soon. They've got scripts. Kurtzman has talked about the writer's room. He's talked about going into he constantly talks about it as if it's been announced, but it hasn't been announced, but it's going to be announced.
Yeah. Not the only one who talks about it as if it's been announced. We've seen it on social from other people. We won't call them out. But they say it and then they sort of backtrack a little bit because it hasn't been made official, but I think they should, they'll probably do it soon.
And it's unclear what the order is, but I think it's going to go something like this. I think the next show to go into production will be Discovery. Then it will be, which will be in Canada. Then it'll be Picard. So Discovery will probably go into production this year. Definitely by December. Picard sometime early next year, January, February. And then Strange New Worlds sometime after that. So in theory, all three could be in production at the same time.
Sure.
This wasn't their plan, but it just kind of happened this way because nothing has happened since March. And Picard was supposed to start shooting in June. In a different interview, he has talked about how Strange New World is benefiting from being able to start their season with all their scripts done, which will be true of Picard as well. I don't know if that's going to be true with Discovery, but basically all of these seasons are going to have a lot more prep time, and hopefully that will benefit the shows.
I think it will. I mean, so many of the different series have a history of pages being delivered the night before shooting. All the actors have talked about it. Certainly that was happening in Discovery season one. I heard a lot of stories about that too. So it would be nice for them, I think, to have things figured out ahead of time, and hopefully we'll make for better scripts and better episodes.
Now, the big question on everyone's mind is, okay, so when do we get to see the next Star Trek live action show? And I don't know when that will be. I mean, there was an executive from CBS who said 2021 for Picard season two. Maybe by the end of the year.
Yeah,
maybe.
That feels ambitious, but who knows?
It has a somewhat shorter, I think, post time than Discovery, because there's a bit less effects, or at least there was in season one. So even though Discovery may start before Picard, Picard may end up being ready before Discovery. And they'd probably like to do it that way anyway, because you go, you know, Picard, Discovery, then Picard again, the Discovery again. With Strange New Worlds in there somewhere. But 2021, it's probably going to be Prodigy and Lower Decks, and then the beginning of some live action close to the end of the year, with 2022 probably being the big year for more live action.
Right. And hopefully with things in the world a little more back to normal as well.
Now, the thing that got people talking the most is something kind of not an offhand comic, but Kurtzman was asked about the movies, and he said, I'm not involved in Star Trek movies. And we've talked a lot about this recently. The movies are on hold now. Paramount's kind of thinking what to do next. But Alex put it out there, I'm not involved, but I'd like to see, and he used the word unification, between the movies and the TV shows. He said this could be done in a number of ways. I'm not sure he's saying, you know, specifically I want the Kelvin timeline to merge with our canon timeline or vice versa. But he would like to see a unified Star Trek cinematic universe. And
I think you have a kind of a unique perspective on this because you're very tied into the movies. And how do you see that? Like, what do you think he means by that more specifically?
Well, I'm not sure what he means specifically, but I think he would like to see his universe stuff eventually flow into the feature films in kind of the old school fashion.
Oh, okay.
So this may not be something that happens for the next Star Trek movie per se, or be related to the Kelvin timeline. Maybe they could start dropping hints in both that they're at least working together, because it doesn't appear that they are at this point.
Right.
I suspect he would like to see them all in the same universe again. And I'm not sure how that would happen.
It sounds exhausting.
It is. Now, the man who was the last person tasked to write a Star Trek script was Noah Hawley. And his movie was put on hold, and he did an interview last week with Collider. It's a real, you know, it's a good interview if you're a fan of his, because he covers a lot of stuff, but he briefly talked about Star Trek movies. And it was a bit ponderous, because he wasn't saying anything specifically about his movie, but what he was basically saying is Paramount isn't interested in doing small movies. They want to do tentpole movies. And it looks like maybe he was hired to do a smaller movie, and now Paramount's thinking about doing a bigger movie again. And so he starts questioning, you know, where is the line when there's so much Star Trek on TV that something is worth making a feature film?
Right. I mean, it's a big challenge. And then there's also a school of thought that Star Trek is better on TV.
Well, everything is better on TV now in peak TV, where you could really look at the characters and you could really do all sorts of interesting explorations that you just can't do in film. But there is but films can serve a different purpose and they have to be a lot more spectacle. And I think he kind of shies away from that. He doesn't want to do a big action blockbuster tentpole movie.
Right.
Reading between the lines, it sounds like he's kind of saying that's what Paramount is more interested in moving towards again, although they are yet to, you know, actually, you know, budget out something. So who knows? He kind of made a weird comment about, you know, but maybe I could, he didn't say I could, but he says maybe if Paramount wasn't interested in the $20 million Star Trek movie, maybe CBS All Access would be, which was an interesting comment.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good idea, I think. I'm just looking at his quote. He said, let me make it, just being hypothetical, not being him himself. But he said, I'm sure you could go to CBS All Access and say, let me make a 2-hour Star Trek movie for streaming. Which is, you know, the same way that they're experimenting with Short Treks, doing something different. It might be an interesting thing to try to do just a standalone 2-hour Star Trek movie.
And, you know, in the era of COVID, we're seeing a lot of movies that were kind of medium movies and going to streaming services instead.
Right. And they're still trying to figure out, will people pay extra for that? You know, is it worth it? So there are so many, the business is in a huge time of shift because of what's been going on. So I think everybody's kind of rethinking all of the different options.
Right. Like, would Star Trek fans pay, like, Disney's charged people who pay for Disney Plus,
yeah,
an extra $30 to watch Mulan.
I did not pay.
But then I think next month they're going to put one of the a Pixar movie on there, and I don't think they're going to charge $30.
Right. They have a big challenge there because they charge $30 for Mulan. That means they can't put it on there for free, like for subscribers for quite some time.
Exactly. So we're in a weird world. COVID and the rise of streaming services, it's making a lot of these big decisions interesting. And I think Star Trek is going to be pulled into them as Viacom, CBS try to get a handle on what to do with the new Paramount Plus and with the Star Trek feature films.
Yeah. Let's move on to the next item, which is, it's a sad one.
Well, it's totally expected.
Yes.
But Star Trek Las Vegas 2020 is not going to happen. It was moved to December, but as we got closer to December, it's becoming clearer and clearer in-person events are not going to happen. But it's more than just canceled. It's over.
Yeah.
There will never be a Creation Star Trek Las Vegas ever again. Creation no longer have the license as of the end of this year, so the era of Star Trek Las Vegas conventions has ended, at least for that name.
And this was going to be maybe the 1 year I finally made it there. I mean, I wasn't planning for December, but back before all this happened when it was still August, I was like, maybe I'll finally get my butt to Las Vegas for STLV. But no, I've missed the whole era.
Well, but you haven't, because Creation are just going to do a convention at the Rio, which is where they've always done it.
Right.
Next August, which is when they always do it. They're going to bring in a bunch of Star Trek celebrities, and they're just not going to call it Star Trek Las Vegas. It's going to be called the 55-year mission. And you know, they did non-branded Star Trek stuff before, even while they were doing branded Star Trek stuff. So this isn't all that different for them. They've just basically got out of the official business and they're going back into the unofficial Star Trek convention business. All indications are there will be an official Star Trek convention just put on by another company and CBS. We don't have news officially announced on who that will be and when that will be, but I'm not sure that will be in 2021. I mean, Disney just announced that their next big Star Wars event is going to be 2022. Some other big 2021 events are already moving to 2022 to be safe. So it's unclear when the next big official USA Star Trek convention. One of the reasons why we're bringing this up is these events are always a good time for news. We were hoping there would be news in December because CBS uses these events as an opportunity to release trailers, do panels, blah, blah, blah. So we're now missing out on that December event.
But in the meantime, for all the people missing the live events, there are virtual cons still going on. And there's one right that started today?
Yes. They did this a couple months ago. It was called Virtual Trek Con. It's Cirek Loftin and the team behind his podcast have just use their podcasting channels on YouTube to put on live and pre-recorded panels. And there's a big lineup. It's unofficial, but a lot of DS9 people, of course, because Cirek knows all those people.
Right.
But today, we're recording this on Thursday. So when you're listening to this, we'll be traveling back in time. There's a panel from Mike McMahon from Lower Decks. And there's going to be a Discovery panel with some of the actors from Discovery. And that'll be the first time they talk since the premiere. So check out Virtual Trek Con 2 is what they're calling it.
Cool. Yeah, I will. There's a lot of good, they have a lot of good people lined up, and I've enjoyed a lot of the virtual panels from them and from others that really allowed them to dig into stuff that maybe you wouldn't get to in a more formal interview setting where they just end up chatting. And just as a fan, it's been really nice to watch these things unfold.
I mean, one of the best panels of the year, I think, was the one with Robert Hewitt Wolf,
yes,
and Armin Shimerman.
Yeah, that
just
was
just talking
great
about what it's like to be a writer and an actor working on the show and how they never talk to each other and rarely talk to each other. And it was just, you know, really gave you an insight into what it was like making Star Trek in the 90s. So hopefully there'll be more of those for Virtual Trek Con 2. Okay, moving on.
Big day. That, you got a big day.
That is you. Part one.
That hope is you.
That hope is you.
Yes.
Exactly. Sorry.
That is you. That is you, Tony. That,
you are you. Okay. No. Sorry. Both of us are running on not a lot of sleep right now. So. Yeah.
Forgive us.
But they're calling this one a part one. And I almost feel like that's a promise from them, because this episode is a little bit of a surprise if you just watched it cold and you haven't been paying attention to all the news and stuff, and you didn't read our interview with Jonathan Frakes where he basically told you this was going to happen.
Right. But so, he did spell it out pretty clearly.
He was very clear, you know, good old Jonathan Frakes in there with the spoilers. You watch this episode and you may be going, where's Tilly? You know, and where's Saru?
Where's the ship?
Where's the ship? And nowhere to be found.
Yeah.
It's all Michael all the time. Wall to wall, Michael Burnham for the full hour.
But it's also, we're building a new world. And so I think not rushing into it by filling in every single detail is a smart way to go.
Yeah, I agree. It was a bold move, but I think it was worth the risk, because what they did is everything you were looking at was new. She wasn't in her uniform. There's like nothing you can't, except she had like a phaser and a tricorder. It's like the only little pieces of the 23rd century. As soon as she showed up, she sent her suit away.
Yes.
So there was nothing left. It was just her and this whole new world, which is all shot in Iceland. And God, they didn't just take a short, I mean, they spent the whole thing in Iceland, and
they made great use of being on location. It was spectacular to look at.
Yeah. They were outside as much as they could be. I wonder where they must've shot, because there were some interior shots. I don't know if they probably shot those back in Canada, but, I know they spent a few weeks in Iceland, and my God, it is so beautiful and
it's so gorgeous.
Alien.
Yeah, no, it's a perfect place for that kind of thing. It was beautiful. And listen, I did say that they didn't rush, but the rush was definitely at the beginning when it opens and she just basically just goes plummeting in, spinning in and screaming. So that was rushed.
Right. No, yeah, the episode was not a quiet little, you know, character story between Michael Burnham and her new friend, Cleveland Booker. It was very action-packed, even though it did have some nice quiet moments. It just was a new setting. Everyone was new except for Michael. And I think that really resets people's heads. You know, you're not seeing anything. And you get used to, we're in a new century where it's 3188. Everything worked out. Season two is over. She sent the red suit away. It finished the seventh signal. It blew itself up. It's gone. She doesn't have a little time travel machine. She's on her own. And all she has is this little backpack of Starfleet rations and a tricorder and a phaser and a communicator. And she can't get in touch with anyone.
Right. So while we're still at a pretty high level, I think it's worth comparing it to the season premieres of the previous two seasons, because I think it's far surpasses what they did in each of the other seasons for a couple of reasons. I mean, one, I think that if you had never seen Star Trek Discovery and you just heard about this sci-fi show and watched this, I think it would be compelling on its own. I don't think you need the previous two seasons. And frankly, I felt that season one's premiere was not that compelling. And I think the events of that, had they been that compelling and interesting, they would have revisited them in a bigger way. And I don't think we ever dug more into her choices. We knew that she had to live with them, but we didn't really get into them. I don't think they were thoroughly thought out in certain ways, or they were changed along the way. And the season two opener didn't grab me that much either. I liked a lot of the early episodes, but not the season opener. I think it was trying too hard, relying on nostalgia, familiar characters, sort of satisfying moments that were too easy and weren't that satisfying. So this one, to me, just drew you in from the get-go and already told you there's a really fascinating story to come. I mean, do you agree with that?
67% of that. I really liked the season two opener. I felt that it reset the show. It was heavily reliant on the Pike Spock Enterprise-ness, of course.
That's where we're going to disagree on whether it was good or not.
But, you know, it was action packed. It was a whole new style. Alex Kurtzman directed it, and I think he really reset the show in a good way. There was that really bad character Connolly, which I hated.
Yeah.
You know, so it definitely had its downsides. Season one opener was kind of this weird, you know, it's a two-parter, and it was this weird prequel movie to the show.
Right.
I always felt it was a mistake. I always thought they should drop all these Michael things throughout season one, not putting the Discovery. The real pilot of the show was episode three. And so I never liked it. But I think that was more a function of the multiple showrunners and the chaos and, you know, season one just, you know, had all those problems. This was just a nice, tight, simple sci-fi movie. It was an alien environment. There was lots of aliens in it. How many humans did we see in this episode? Are we assuming, Book is a human? Let's assume he's a human. You know, there weren't a lot of humans. It was very alien, lots of aliens.
Yeah. I love Book. I think David Ajala is amazing. I think he brings a lesser actor wouldn't have been able to make all of that as interesting as it was. And I think he just brings a complexity and a depth to what he does and doesn't hurt that he's super hot. I loved his character and the little tidbits of details, even in that opening scene with him, when we already, you know, you get that Han Solo, that over the top Han Solo vibe from him, except that it's immediately sort of set up that he's got a morality streak right away. Because he's saying, you know, the alien, Cosmo, is saying, "You stole my cargo." And his answer is, "It belongs to itself."
Right. And he says something like, "Get an open mind." So he's kind of a 32nd century woke guy, you know, tweeting back, you know, that Cosmo is definitely closed-minded.
Right.
He's not a smuggler with the heart of gold.
No.
He's roguish, and there is something definitely more to him than that. You know, we're kind of introduced to him as this action-y guy with a cargo ship, but we find out he's got a sort of mission of his own. He's got an interesting backstory, which we'll hopefully learn more about, his family. He's some kind of genetic anomaly. He's got a glowing forehead.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what's going on. Is that genetic? Is he partially technology? Some people are saying he's a synth, which I'm not buying.
Yeah, I don't think that.
But I think he might have synthetic components. I think maybe everyone in the future has synthetic components. Maybe that's just normal. There was that bit where Michael couldn't get into the bazaar.
The mercantile, right?
The mercantile. So she didn't. There was something she didn't have, and it's unclear if that's something that you're supposed to be wearing, or maybe it's embedded in you.
Right. It was under his sleeve, so we didn't get to see it. Oh, and then right. When he was shirtless, I didn't see anything on him. But again, that doesn't necessarily tell us anything.
He did hand her a little thing to put on her wrist to communicate to the ship. That might have been it. So it might be external. You know,
right.
These are all questions which we'll be exploring. But, you know, there definitely is some interesting technology going on in the 32nd century that we haven't seen before. But it more that he is a rich character. And Ajala played him very subtly. There was these very subtle moments.
Oh, yeah. So many.
These looks he would give her. Oh.
Okay. Sorry,
you're melting.
I know. I'm a heterosexual woman. So I have to say, like, his little wink. I had in my own notes for myself. I wrote comments that maybe I can't repeat here, but about things I thought he was conveying to her. Like, there were moments where I felt like his little look said, "Should we go somewhere?" So, but he's great with the looks. He's great with the layered meanings to things. So yeah, A plus for him all around.
I mean, it was a little of a trope for two people we know are going to hook up at some point to meet and be fighting, you know. It's sure. Very Tracy Hepburn.
Yes.
Except I don't remember Hepburn ever punching Tracy, and I think she punched him at least twice in this episode. Yeah. So, there's definitely a dynamic. There's great chemistry. He's also able to rattle off technobabble, you know, which is not easy to do. Certainly, you know, we've seen Tig Notaro and other people come to the show and struggle with that. So,
yep.
You know, all in all, one of the better introductions, I would say on par with the introduction of Anson Mount last season.
See, we've had this discussion not on the podcast. I did not enjoy his introduction. I eventually came to love that character, and I think Anson Mount is terrific. So I'll be brief in this, but it made Neil Shirley laugh when I told him this. So I'm just going to say it again, which is that I felt like when Pike showed up, he was like the substitute teacher who shows up to a school where nobody wears jeans, and he's wearing jeans and he's got a guitar on his back and he's trying to tell everybody to call him by his first name because he's so cool and you're going to love him. So I thought he came on way too folksy, strong. Look, I'm so benevolent and I'm so fun and you can love me. And I thought it was much too over the top. And then eventually I think he settled in and I ended up really liking the character, and I'm very much looking forward to Strange New Worlds, but I did not like his character intro at all. And I know I'm in the minority, but I didn't.
I disagree. I'll just say what I said back then, which was he was like the perfect Starfleet captain grown in some Starfleet lab somewhere to be the opposite of Lorca, and it worked. Okay, moving on.
Yes. Let's stay in season 3. And, you know, we talk about these things not just when we're having a podcast, so we've had a lengthy discussion about it.
There was some other new people I really liked. And I hope this isn't the only time we're going to see him, the character of Sahil,
yeah.
the Federation liaison, the kind of unofficial, now official Federation liaison, played by a guy named Adil Hussain, who's kind of a big deal in India. When he showed up in the first trailer, there were all these articles in India about him, about how he's in Star Trek, because he's been in a lot of movies there. He was in Life of Pi, so this isn't his first foray into Hollywood, but he is a very strong actor, award-winning, and it would be a waste if this was the only time we see him.
Yeah, I hope we see more of him. Plus, I liked all his stuff. I liked his alarm clock that was a bird.
Right.
I mean, it felt like something my grandmother would love, but still, I enjoyed it. And I liked all of his, I liked his tooth cleaning, because I kept thinking, maybe we don't have dentists. And sorry, dentists, but nobody likes going. So maybe there are no more dentists, because you can just go like, and then your teeth just get cleaned. I liked all his stuff that disappeared and reappeared. I liked his tech a lot. And as a person, he just had an intensity that I appreciated, and a sort of deep sadness you could feel even as he kind of went about his routine, which is why that closing scene with him was so powerful.
There was a new character who we didn't see much of and we're never going to see again, which was Cosmo.
Which was played by David Benjamin Tomlinson, who plays Linus.
And has played a couple of Klingons.
And I think a Kelpian as well.
He was kind of a good, true roguish, true bad guy, true smuggler thief character.
And he was sort of funny, because when he couldn't kill Book, he just was like, well, can I shoot her then? Like, he was very
amoral.
He just wanted to shoot somebody, but he's gone now.
Yeah. I really liked, I don't have the actors' names, but there was kind of a pair of Andorian and Orion who were kind of running the mercantile, and they had a bit of a, I don't know, an Abbott Costello. I don't know. There's something funny about the pair.
Yes.
I just liked them a lot.
Yeah. So
even though they were ruthless, and, you know, one of them did kill Cosmo for, you know, not delivering the merchandise. So they were not nice guys.
No, but they were a comedy duo of sorts.
Right. They're, you know, they're torturing her. They're talking about getting sandwiches. That's, you know,
that was one of my favorite lines. I'm hungry. Let's get a sandwich.
So, yeah, that and this all brings the richness of this 32nd century. And they're making a point, which is, okay, who are the bad guys we know? Okay, well, Orions are bad guys. We know that they're pirates and they're thieves, and that's been, you know, they're slavers. That's pretty well established. Well, who's one of the good guys? Okay, well, you know, there was three founding members of the Federation, you know, the Andorians, and, or not three, there's four, right? So the humans, Andorians, Vulcans, and Tellarites, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so let's take one of them, you know, one of the good guys, and we put them together to show, you know, we're in a different world here, and these people shouldn't be working together, but they are. And I think we're going to see more and more of that. And Alex Kurtzman has said, he's kind of hinted that whoever the big bad guy is going to be this season is someone that we're used to being a good guy. And we're going to see the opposite of that as well. So, you know, don't be surprised if, you know, we run into some, I don't know.
Don't say Vulcans. I just don't want Vulcans to be bad.
No. I think the Vulcans are going to be good guys, but who knows? Who knows? You know, just pull any bad guy, except not the Borg, because it's not going to be the right. Borg, you know, and, you know, flip them on their head and vice versa. And I think this episode set that up pretty well. I did like some of the other aliens. We saw a Lurian.
Yeah, that was fun.
Who didn't say anything.
Of course not.
I thought it would have, I mean, they could have leaned into that. You know, they could have had him like about to say something and someone tells him to shut up or something.
Or but, he gets shot or eaten or whatever.
Right. Just as he was about to say something.
Right. You know? The worm would come and go. So.
Perhaps the most significant new character is Meow. Grudge the cat.
Yeah. So I have some Grudge theories already. I'm sure you do too. But I think Grudge is more than just a cat.
I'm going to write about this on the site. I definitely feel that when Book says Grudge is a queen, I think he means Grudge is a queen.
Yes.
Like, literally. I think what we're seeing is some kind of manifestation, because Michael picks up Grudge and says Grudge is heavy. And I think maybe Book says something like she has a thyroid condition. Like, it was a thyroid condition in the 32nd century. I think that maybe shapeshifter or some kind of being.
Yeah.
I mean, God, it's, you know, we're going to be 10 episodes in and it's just going to be a cat. I know, but I think that there's something going on here. You think there's something going on
here? Well, because there was one other line, because Cosmo, I think it was, threatens Grudge when he's beating up Book and talks about doing something to Grudge and says, she'll feed a whole planet.
Yeah, which is either just like a your mama's so fat joke, or he's being literal and Grudge is some kind of giant creature that can shrink down to the size of a cat. Who knows?
Yeah, because
we've seen a cat transform before. Yeah, Gary Seven.
Yep,
had a cat like that. So there is cat precedence.
I was gonna say there's precedent. So yeah, I just got that vibe. Like, it just seemed so much more than just there's a pet. There was something right. else and, going on.
Well, and this gets into there's something about Book, because it's not just Grudge, it's Book has some kind of commune with nature. He's like some mm-hmm. space druid. He can talk to the animals. He's a Dr. Doolittle,
and you know, plants. He can
talk to plants yeah. and plants. And yet he kind of said it's kind of a burden, I think, in a way, because she said, "What's it like?" And he said, "Painful."
Right. Well, she said, "What's it like feeling everything?" Right.
Yeah. So. Yeah, you know, so
he said uncomfortable. That's what he said.
Right. So, you know, there's definitely, he's not 100% everyday bog standard human being. That is for sure.
You and can somehow say that again. No, but I agree with you. I'm like the annoying dude who keeps talking about some woman saying, and she's so hot. So I'll try to restrain myself because that is just as obnoxious coming from me.
That's you know, obviously they knew what they were doing when they were casting David Ajala.
Yes, they did.
Go ahead.
No, that's it. I was going to just mention more cute things he did, so I'm going to stop.
The list goes on.
I know, it's terrible. Well, because they gave him a shirtless scene already, which I was happy about.
So, I know.
They're moving fast.
How are they going to top that? Well, I know they're going to top that.
Okay, we better switch topics at this point.
We're switching to fan fiction at this point.
Yeah, I'm going to just stop. So there's go ahead.
Well, you touched on this a little bit, and I want to go back to some of the technology we saw. And I think are they calling it smart matter? Is that what they're calling it?
Oh, I don't know. I didn't the stuff in the, you know, that Starfleet supposed, you know, that what's left of Starfleet has.
Well, if you notice, a lot of people have it. It's David Ajala's ship uses it. I think it's just kind of there, mm-hmm. you know, she's all fascinated by it. He thinks it's boring and, you know, run of the mill. So I think everyone's got this kind of, stuff, you know, all their weapons would just come out of nowhere.
Yeah.
So I think it's on their clothes or it's on their persons, but people are carrying these kind of nanoparticles or something, and they could turn into whatever you want them to turn into. And hopefully this doesn't get too magical. Remember the magical ocarina from the series finale of Picard?
Oh, yeah. It's whatever you that want it to be. Yeah, it's the magic tool.
Yeah, but they aren't doing that with this yet. But I think we're going to be seeing a lot of this stuff this season. This is kind of their new cool thing, and I like it so far.
Yeah, same.
It shows that they're still spending a lot of money on the show, because every time they use it, that's a lot of money,
right? You can just cha-ching, put a thing up on the screen while we're watching.
Yeah. So her tech is
all called antiques by everybody.
Right. They made out of, you know, the materials aren't even used anymore, you know, he said.
Right.
He calls her Rocket Girl.
Which she does not like.
No. No. So that was the ultimate insult. The other fun bit of technology, which she thought was really cool and he thought was mundane, was instant transporters or personal transporters.
Portable transporters, I think they called it.
Yeah.
Which felt, it felt to me like, you know, the way, as every good Star Trek fan knows. Okay, every Star Trek fan knows. I'm not going to be qualifying with good and bad. You know, they invented the transporter as it was a storytelling device. It was to avoid long scenes of ships traveling, landing, and ascending again. And so I feel like this could also be a great storytelling device. They don't have to go to a room. You know, they don't need someone at the controls. You can just beam from one place to the other.
Right. Everyone is their own O'Brien.
Yes. Poor O'Brien. He's probably just still standing alone in that room, like in that comic.
Waiting for someone to come in.
And nobody does.
he's been put out of a job again.
He's still got a statue, so it's fine. But but yeah, I think that could end up being very interesting and fun to watch and create some good. I mean, they made great use of it in the action sequences. I'm not a big fan of fight scenes, not morally or philosophically, but I just get bored. It's just not my particular thing. But at least a chase scene is kind of interesting when they're beaming away and then beaming somewhere else and then waiting for them to arrive and they have their weapons trained on them and then they pop in. And of course, the jumping over a cliff thing, which was kind of cliche, but fun. So I think
very Butch and Sundance.
Yes, exactly. That's what it made me think of too. So, but I think it will create, it'll help with storytelling, I think, and make sequences more exciting.
Well, but the smart thing they're doing is they're already giving it limitations. Mm-hmm. It needs 30 seconds to warm up. You can't track it through solid materials, but you can track it in the open. So they are thinking about it instead of just saying, here's this magical thing that everyone could use at any time.
Right.
And there's probably going to be other interesting uses of it in the future.
Right.
And this will be a question when we get to the Discovery. It's going to be part of the show for the season, and it'll be curious how much they integrate things. And I guess, well, we shouldn't talk about upcoming episodes and stuff like that. We haven't seen them yet, but you know, we've seen stuff from the trailers, so we know that eventually Burnham is going to make it back to the Discovery at some point.
Yes, the other actors are still in the show.
Yeah. Exactly.
But I think the same way, you know, one of the things they constantly had to do on all Star Treks is come up with reasons the transporter didn't work when they needed it to not work. And so they'll obviously have to do the same thing here.
Yeah. And communications, which was her whole, I mean, her goal, you know, every good story, you have a character that has a goal. Her goal this episode was she wanted to make a phone call.
Yes.
And, she couldn't do it all episode, and then eventually Ajala or Book revealed that he could have made that phone call at any time. He was just manipulating her.
It's very Wizard of Oz. Dorothy could have gone home long before.
Although the phone call
went
nowhere.
Right.
Yes. There's no one's answering on the Discovery.
I mean, she just kept saying, Discovery, are you there? I was like, I hope they're doing something else besides just saying, Discovery, are you there? It seemed a little simplistic to me.
So, with that, and she did finally, that's when we met Sahil, when she finally really learned that Discovery is 100% nowhere to be found. And even worse, possibly know when to be found.
Right.
Which is something we hadn't considered, but we probably should have considered. Which is, it's quite possible that the Discovery doesn't show up at the same time she shows up.
Right. They said, by the laws of temporal mechanics, they could arrive tomorrow or in 1,000 years.
So it kind of feels like she's going to have to wait for the Discovery or find it somewhere. It was interesting that he detected 2 Federation ships. Somewhere out there.
Right.
So the Federation's not gone. He's alone. He hasn't talked to anyone in 30 years. Somehow he's not crazy. Right? Like, he should be super crazy, but he's not.
Yeah, he doesn't seem bored either. Which seems weird. Right.
Yeah, he must have, like, just a great library. There must be a holodeck or... Maybe the smart, obviously smart matter is better than the holodeck, right. Because the smart matter probably creates any environment you want around you.
Or he's got smart matter Netflix. I don't know, but he needs something.
Yes. Although it does kind of feel like, you know, soon after they show up, they're going to leave him all alone again.
Yeah. And he's back to his desk job. You know, they always give the desk job negative connotations on Star Trek. And he seemed like the epitome of that because the poor guy just doesn't do anything.
Yeah. But now he's going to be searching. That's his job every day, scanning.
And hopefully finding.
Yes. So he's bound to come back. He's at some point.
And back to Burnham. I mean, they have talked about, I've heard in some interviews, that it will be a while. They're not reunited immediately, Burnham and the rest of the Discovery crew, that there's some time that's going to pass.
Well, all you had to do was watch the trailer that came out 11 to 13 months ago.
Yeah.
And just look at her hair.
Mm-hmm.
So
her beautiful
it
hair.
Grows.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that wasn't overnight, unless she, you know, popped into some 32nd century salon and got extensions. Her hair is going to grow out, so it's going to take some time.
Yeah, there's been some great speculation about who does her hair like that, because I think it's the kind of thing that is very difficult to do yourself. So Does the ship have something built in that does it? I don't know.
I try to keep my ear to the grindstone of Star Trek, and this is the first I've heard of this speculation, and yet it makes total sense. So I guess I'm missing out on the hair talk, but it's a good point.
There was a great conversation about it. It was actually on the official Star Trek podcast, because they had Michelle Hurd and Tani Newsom, who hosts it, and Kendra James, who's the managing editor of the site, and someone else whose name I feel terrible for forgetting right now. And they're all Black women talking about hair, which is a big issue. And saying, yeah, I want to know who's doing that. And I want to know that in the future, there's going to be some computer that's going to be able to manage that.
Well, we're back to the smart matter. I suspect that we may never see it, but on book ships, you could just tell the ship to manifest a pair of hands and braid her hair.
Yeah.
But that may be a cutting room floor or off-screen situation.
Right. I don't think they're going to explore it that much. Although I feel like if Sonequa had her way, they would mention it at some point, because that's been an issue for her. It's something she's brought up in interviews as well. It's also, look, something I think about with Star Trek and a lot of TV shows anyway, is when women who are so coiffed and so made up, but don't have lives or jobs that seem conducive to doing those things. Like Janeway always having fresh lipstick in the middle of a crisis. Like, I don't know about future lipstick, but I know current lipstick is gone in half an hour. So the idea that you'd be in battle and still have fresh lipstick on seems a little crazy to me. So, they don't usually address these things, but maybe at some point they will.
But through this episode, they did not glam up Michael Burnham at all. She was cut and scratched and bleeding. And, she was not looking all dolled up.
Yeah, I'm just thinking in the scenes that you're talking about with the hair, I believe she had a lot of makeup on there too.
Yeah.
But she's beautiful with or without the makeup. She's absolutely gorgeous.
So are there any other character moments that you want to talk about? Or do you want to move on to, because there's some kind of nerdy stuff I want to talk about.
Well, my favorite scene with her, and I think you love this one too, because I read your review, is the one where they give her, they dose her, or overdose her really, because they give her more than they're supposed to. And I just think first of all, it was very funny to watch and very entertaining. She had such great range covering all these moods and thoughts and moments. And that was a huge highlight for me. And I think it's something Discovery is actually very good at, which is finding these strong character moments in the story that don't take you out of it.
It was very funny, but I thought they were making a point there. It was kind of like she had a weird psychoactive therapy session with herself through these drugs, where she suddenly had these realizations about herself.
Mm-hmm.
And her own savior complex and how she's overcompensated. So, no, I thought it was a great, funny scene that also had a point, because Michael is changing for the better. She's giving up all her guilt. First season, she was just a mess, right? Because mm-hmm. of the Klingon War. Second season, she was dealing with all her brother stuff. I think now she's just back to being, having a little fun and having a mission and being a Starfleet officer. And sure, she's facing challenges, but she just isn't, a mess with her Vulcan upbringing and all that.
She's free of her past in a very literal sense as well as a figurative one. She's left it all behind, which is the guilt, the choices she made, the upbringing, everything is completely gone. And I think it's going to make her a much more fun character to watch.
Yeah. And I think that was the point of that scene.
Yep. All right. Now nerdy stuff. Bring it on.
Okay. Let's talk about the burn.
The burn.
The burn. If you're one of the people who avoided spoilers, this is the first time you've heard of it, but we've been speculating about the burn for weeks, and we've talked about it on the podcast. It was teased in the trailer, and they've talked about it on these panels, and it was the thing that caused the Federation to collapse. some cataclysm. We now know it happened roughly 100 years before. So this would put it a few years after the last point of the Star Trek timeline, because we saw Daniels, remember Daniels from Star Trek Enterprise, was a 31st century character. So sometime after Daniels and his time cops, I mean, they were called something else, but they're basically time cops, were doing their thing. Starfleet still existed. The Federation still existed. Everything was fine in the 31st century. Then late in the century, boom, every piece of dilithium explodes, according to book.
Right.
Or most pieces of dilithium. So we'd theorized it was all tied to Voyager. It was this kind of cool canon connection thing, because what that would do is it would make the Discovery the most important ship in the fleet, because no one can travel because subspace is all screwed up. We were kind of in the ballpark because essentially travel is extremely limited. Communications are limited, but it's because of this dilithium thing.
Right.
And it's more a scarcity story, which could be interesting. You know, dilithium is always been kind of the, you know, space gasoline. Even though the ships don't actually run on the dilithium that we can get into, you know, it's the matter and antimatter is the fuel, and deuterium, and the crystals are just used to create the reaction.
Right.
Okay. Stop the nerds.
Yeah.
Stuff. I still have a lot of questions about the burn, and I hope that we get more, because they kind of built it up.
I don't think they're going to drop it. I think they're going to dig in and will eventually uncover what happened and why.
You know, the nerdier fans, myself included, because the thing I liked about the Voyager theory is it disrupted subspace, which basically meant most, if not all, forms of faster than light travel, except the spore drive, wouldn't work. If you get rid of dilithium, you still leave a lot of things open, and they kind of waved their hand around things like quantum slipstream.
Right.
And
they name checked them, at least.
Yeah, they name checked elements used in these things, but not really explaining away. I mean, if all dilithium was this scarce, people would find another way. So hopefully they kind of get into that and not just ignore it. So I'm not disappointed yet, but I'm somewhat concerned.
Sure.
there was some serious hand waving, because another big question is time travel. That, you know, here they are, they're in, the whole point of this endeavor was to get away from the big evil robot control AI, get the sphere data away from it, but you just really needed to get the ship away from it.
Right.
There's no reason why they all need to stay.
I know.
In the 32nd century. And, you know, if they were really the temporal prime directive, they should all just go home. Really. They don't belong there. This isn't their century. They should just leave. They should leave the ship there, buried in an ocean, and all go home. But, of course, we know that they're not going to do that. And they're not going to do that for the new mission. But he had this thing where he said, oh, there's no more time travel technology, because it was declared illegal. And I thought, well, that's kind of
easy. Yeah.
It's too easy. And it's like as if any of these guys care about something that's, quote, illegal. There's no one, you know, she already said no one's taking care of the endangered species. So who's making sure no one's building time machines?
Right. Like he says it was destroyed, but we know that things can be destroyed and you can rebuild them.
Yeah. You didn't. I mean, there was, you know, one theory had that somehow the burn created a kind of line where you couldn't pass over a certain point in time travel. You know, I mean, you could have created some, you know, hoo-ha technobabble to say, oh, you can't travel backwards past the 31st century because of the burn or something. So that was unsatisfying. I'm going to say right off the bat.
Yeah, I would agree.
If that's all, you know, because she sent away her time machine, and he said, "Up, oh, there's no time travel tech, so no one will ever mention time travel again."
Right.
And also we have the Giorgio problem. So I'm hoping time travel comes up again. I mean, Daniels again. You know, for those of you who didn't pay attention in Star Trek Enterprise class, talked about how time travel was taught in high schools in the 31st century. Everyone knew how to time travel. So they can't just...
That seems ill-advised, but I know what you mean.
Exactly. I mean, do you want to give your average high school... I mean, look what they do with social media. You don't want to give them time travel.
No.
You know, that is not a good idea. You know, they waved it away because it's inconvenient, because again, like certain technologies, it's too powerful, but they can't make it that easy to wave away. Then again, they waved away the Spore Drive at the end of season 2. It's just, okay, everyone's going to forget this exists.
Right. We will never speak of it again.
Which apparently worked, because when they, you know, in the 32nd century, the universe should be full of Spore ships, and it's not.
Right.
Thankfully for them.
Right. Sadly for the Federation. But thankfully for our intrepid crew.
I mean, that's all my kind of nerdy stuff that I've got on this episode, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, I just thought that they did, you know, from a storytelling perspective, I think they did a great job of introducing pieces at a great pace. I thought it moved really well, slowed down when it needed to. It had some great lines of dialogue that made me laugh or just write them down because I thought they were so good. Like, I love when she guesses that she's high when she says it, but she guesses that his cargo, because it's temperature sensitive and really valuable, she goes, so it's probably ice cream. Or that his access code is the word sticky, which I thought was good. So they did. And just her whole reaction to the fact, you know, as always, 10,000 things happen to Michael Burnham at once, and this is just her fate. It's always going to happen, no matter what. And in this case, I mean, her systems are failing, and she's spinning out of control and crash lands. And then she's in the water. She's a prisoner. She gets high. She gets almost devoured by a worm and ends up with sticky goo all over her. So all that stuff, they just keep it coming. And that was very fun to watch.
And I mean, they didn't show it, but you have to think, this is literally the same day she fought in the battle against the control ships, and she had to say goodbye to her brother, and you know, that was all just like, from her perspective, a couple hours ago.
Right, like she just, when we first see her, she's just popped through that wormhole, and she's by herself, and now she's spinning out of control. So she is, I mean, at some point she says, today does not happen to people, ever. Like, she's just got this insane day that nobody else would even understand every single thing that she's been through, that she certainly wasn't expecting when she woke up earlier that morning.
Yeah. So good episode. I think one of my favorite lines, you know, in that whole era of her being high was how she didn't use Tilly's name, but I think she said something about she has a redheaded friend and they should never give her the drug.
Yes.
Because could you imagine Tilly on that drug?
I don't think you'd notice that much of a difference.
I think she would start talking so fast you couldn't hear it.
Right.
That you know, she would like move into ultrasonic or something.
I think that whole monologue has so much good stuff in it that you could just write it all out and break apart each sentence and they all stand well on their own.
Yeah. And who knew she could do humor? It's not her thing. And it's not easy to do.
No, she's great at it. She's great. She's always great at expressing a range of emotion when they finally let her do it. And she did not fail to deliver in this one.
Speaking of emotion, that final scene, I mean, I've even seen some diehard skeptics that last scene with the Federation and the flag, has people choked up. And I felt it was earned. It was strong. Yeah. And it really set up the season well. And because they've done attempts at pulling at your strings. There's that big speech she gives at the end of season one, which felt unearned.
Yeah, I didn't like that one at all myself.
So, you know, perhaps they've learned some lessons too. And I thought, because it was subtle, they weren't overplaying their hand. And
no, and hopefully no more VOs. Like, that's another problem that I think.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of, they're sharing the lines and they're sharing the burden. A lot of the cool stuff that happens in this episode is done by book. A lot of the great lines at the end about the Federation came from this guy who's been sitting alone for 30 years.
Yeah.
No, not her. So, you know, she doesn't need to do everything. And I think that's fine.
I agree. I just wanted to call out two funny things that made me think of Lower Decks while I was watching. Which is one, obviously the worm eating her, which happened to Boimler. Was that in the first episode?
Yes.
He gets like this big creature, swallows him up and shakes him around and then spits him out and he's covered in goo. So I thought that was a very funny thing that happened to both of them. And then in the season finale of Lower Decks, where they have the problem, he's trying to like upload the virus and it keeps stalling as, you know, a very 21st century computer problem. And then she had to reboot. It was like, I just thought it's so funny because it's so relatable because these are problems. I mean, you had to reboot before we did this podcast. So these are problems that we have all the time. And I thought it was funny that they came up in both shows, which are otherwise completely different.
And there's no way that they were coordinating at that kind of level because of the way, you know, the timelines of the productions. But these things rhyme.
So are we good for our Discovery season premiere review?
Yeah. I'm, you know, what's funny is all season long of Lower Decks, I was thinking this is a great distraction. It's wonderful for this horrible era that we're living in of 2020 to have this little half hour every week. And it's fun. But I always thought, you know, when we get to Discovery, things are going to get serious. And, you know, sure, it's more serious, but this was fun. It was good times.
And I think it's going to live up to its name, finally, Discovery. I think it's about time we had some discovering, and I think there's going to be a lot of it. I personally am looking forward to crying my eyes out when they all finally reunite, because I love Luck. Tilly can make me cry very easily, but I am looking forward to that heavy emotion. But I also think you're right, there's going to be a lot more fun coming. And certainly the little this season on preview that they have on CBS All Access at the end of the episode, it looks, if that's representative of the season, then I'm very hopeful. I feel like they've learned a lot from the first two.
Right. They learned lessons from season one, applied them in season two, then they somewhat forgot them.
Yeah, that was the problem with season two. It went off to a good start, despite our disagreements about the first episode. And then things just, you know, again, that we know there were shifts and crazy things going on behind the scenes.
Yeah. And that, that's something I said in my review. I may have said this earlier, that all the pieces are in place for this to be the best season yet. And one of those is simply that they aren't changing showrunners halfway through the season.
Yeah. And as a result, we're getting stronger storytelling, at least so far.
Yeah.
I mean, again, if you walked into that cold, you'd like it. You'd be hooked.
So let's switch and talk about our little favorite Trek bits of the week before we round out the show.
All right.
What do you got this week?
So this week I have something. It's not out. It's coming out on October 27th here in the United States. I think it's been a little delayed in Europe. But it's a new book coming out called The Autobiography of Catherine Janeway, and it's written by Una McCormack. And I got to be honest, I read a lot of Star Trek fiction as a kid, and then I just didn't as an adult. And I read a lot of the books that are about making the show, but I don't read fiction. And you very wisely suggested that I interview Una, and therefore I got a preview of the book. I got to read it ahead of time. And so I did the interview, and that's going to come out, the day before the book comes out, probably. But guys, if you are a Voyager fan and you're a Janeway fan, you are going to want to get this book. I thought it was beautifully written. It covers a lot of the missing pieces of her childhood, the decisions she made. You know, Tuvix is like the big decision that people are still arguing about all the time on Twitter. And she goes into why she made the decision and what she thought about and her doubts. You get to see what happens after Voyager returns. You get to the emotional impact of what it was like when they were finally talking to their families again. And the writing's beautiful. So I say, go pre-order this book, which I know always helps the writer, but you won't regret it. It's a great read. And I was so happily surprised, completely absorbed, and got, you know, I'm an emotional person, but I definitely got emotional sometimes. So terrific book. I'm going to now read more of her books. And then I think I'll probably check out the autobiographies of Picard and Kirk that are out there by David Goodman.
Those are both excellent. This is a series by Titan. And so this isn't part of the Pocketbooks line of books. This is from a different publisher, but I think they've all been very strong. And I haven't read this one yet, but I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, so. It's terrific. And then I think people are going to really like the interview when it comes out, because she was wonderful and brought up some of the approaches that she took and things that she wanted to address. I found really fascinating. So you'll see that when we put it on the site.
Now I've got a Voyager thing too. In fact, I've got a Voyager thing right out of your playbook, which is your favorite podcast.
Yes.
The Delta Flyers.
I love that podcast.
Something I caught before you did, because you were so busy in the last week.
Yeah.
Which is a little moment in the latest episode where Robert Duncan McNeil reveals a behind the scenes factoid about the episode Tattoo, which featured a shot of Chakotay from behind, where we get to see kind of a little Chakotay butt.
Did we tell Christine, who works on Trek Movie?
she's obsessed with Chakotay.
Yeah. Anyway, keep going.
Robbie reveals that the butt crack, sorry, this is going to get technical, was added later digitally because he wore a flesh-covered underwear and the studio thought it looked bad, but they only did that because the studio said you're not allowed to show butt. But once they hid the butt, the studio said, well, that looks stupid, so put the butt back in. And they had to digitally add a butt crack. So that's a little piece of Star Trek lore for you.
And then the funny, because I then finally found time to listen to the whole thing. And so later in the podcast, they spontaneously call Robert Picardo to ask him a completely unrelated question. And he's on his bike with his mask on, he points out, biking around. And while he's on the phone with them, he actually falls off his bike. And then he says that he doesn't know if he should reveal this on the podcast, but he's just scarred very severely the upper left side of his butt cheek, his upper butt cheek. So now he's got this huge scratch on his butt. And then while they're talking butts, Robbie brings up that he had a butt injury on Voyager in the Captain Proton sequence where he was burned. And then, of course, you know me, I had to go find that story, which I did. And it was Captain Proton and they put a jetpack on him. And it basically lit his butt on fire and they needed like buckets of water and fire extinguishers. And it was a big deal and it hurt like hell. So it was a very butt-centric episode of the always excellent Delta Flyers podcast.
Yes. Well, I'm glad we got to the bottom of that.
Yeah, I was just waiting. I knew that was coming. Now we can put it in our rearview mirror and move on.
Yes. All right. Well, I think that's quite enough of this episode Access Star Trek.
Thanks for listening, everybody. And come to the site. We've got links to the things that we've talked about, and we would love your feedback. I'm always desperate and hungry for it. I admit it.
Next week, we'll be back, as we are every Friday, talking about all the news and the second episode of Star Trek Discovery Season 3. So please come back.
See you then.
Thanks for listening.